Einstein, June 28th in Science. Such data are important for understanding Earth's climate and the way it's changing. More river surfaces means more contact between water and air, so rivers are probably exchanging more carbon dioxide with the atmosphere than currently assumed. Let me drop for questions or comments. Some members of the human genus Homo left Africa far earlier than thought, reaching what's now central China by around 2.12 million years ago, a new study finds. Some stone tools unearthed at China's Shengchen site date to roughly 250,000 years before what was previously the oldest Eurasian evidence of Homo, according to geologists of the Chinese Academy of Sciences. Toolmakers visited the Chinese spot on and off until as late as 1.26 million years ago. The scientists reported online on July 12th in Nature. No hominid fossils have been found at Shengchen. Until now, the Demasi site in the Western Asian nation of Georgia had yielded the oldest hominid remains outside of Africa. Homo erectus fossils unearthed at Demasi site are dated to between 1.85 and 1.77 million years ago. A co-author of the study believed that an early form of Homo probably made the Shengchen artifacts, but it's too early to say if that was Homo erectus. Let me drop. After learning how to make stone flakes sharp enough to slice meat off animals, carcasses around 2.6 million years ago, African hominids may have had the survival skills to fan out into Asia and reach Shengchen by 2.1 million years ago. Whatever Homo species made that roughly 7,000-kilometer journey, Shengchen now seems to stand out as the oldest hominid site in China by some 400,000 years. Shengchen lacks volcanic rock and can be used to estimate a site's age. Instead, the researchers identified ancient reversals of Earth's magnetic field recorded in minerals within the Chinese site's sediment. Dates for these geological events came from published age estimates for ancient reversals of Earth's magnetic field documented at sites in Africa and elsewhere in the world. Let me drop. Some argue that a previously dated magnetic reversal that corresponds to the oldest one in Shengchen dates to at least 1.95 million years old, not 2.12 million years old. Even so, that quibble of a dating isn't enough to change Shengchen's status as the oldest known hominid site outside of Africa. The most logical conclusion of this new study is that Demasi is not the earliest evidence of occupation in Eurasia. African departures 2 million years ago or more must have led hominid presence at Demasi and Shengchen. Perhaps like non-human carnivores, early Homo traveled far and fast simply by trailing prey animals across the landscape, hunting them and reproducing along the way. Let me drop. Were these toolmakers our ancestors or any living person's ancestors? Perhaps not. Human evolution is not as simple as a straight line that can be printed on a nice t-shirt. It involves dead ends as well as loops and curves back into earlier parts and could give modern man a case of vertigo following them. Like they say in Facebook about relationships, it's complicated. Let me drop for questions or comments. A scientific consortium at the University of Oxford and Max Planck Institute of Science and Human History has found that human ancestors were scattered across Africa and largely kept apart by a combination of diverse habitats and shifting environmental boundaries, such as forests and deserts. Millennia of separation gave rise to staggering diversity of the human form, whose mixing ultimately shaped our species. While it is widely accepted that our species originated in Africa, less attention has been paid to how we evolved within the continent. Many had assumed that early human ancestors originated as a single, relatively large ancestral population and exchanged genes and technologies like stone tools in a more or less random fashion. Let me drop. paper published in Trends in Ecology and Evolution this past week, the zoo is challenged not only by the usual studies of bones, stones, and genes, but also by new and more detailed reconstructions of Africa's climate and habitat over the last 300,000 years. Stone tools and other artifacts, usually referred to as material culture, have remarkably clustered distributions in space through time. The lead author of the study wrote, while there is a continental-wide trend towards more sophisticated material culture, this modernization clearly doesn't originate in one region or occur at one time period. Human fossils tell a very similar story. When they looked at the morphology of human bones over the last 300,000 years, they saw a complex mix of archaic and modern features in different places at different times. As with material culture, they seem to see a continental wide trend towards modern human form, but different modern features appear in different places at different times, and some archaic features are present until remarkably recent. Let me drop. The genes seem to concur. It is difficult to reconcile the genetic patterns we see in living Africans and the DNA extracted in the bones of Africans who lived over 10,000 years ago, with there being one ancestral human population. We see indications of reduced connectivity very deep in the past, some very old genetic lineages, and levels of overall diversity that a single population would struggle to maintain. To understand why human populations were so subdivided and how these divisions changed through time, researchers looked at the past climates and environments of Africa, which give a picture of shifting and often isolated habitable zones. Many of the most inhospitable regions in Africa today, such as the Sahara, were once wet and green, with interwoven networks of lakes and rivers and abundant wildlife. Similarly, some tropical regions that are humid and green today are arid. These shifting environments drove subdivisions within animal communities, and numerous sub-Saharan species exhibit phylogenetic patterns in their distribution. Let me drop. The shifting nature of these habitable zones means that human populations would have gone through many cycles of isolation, leading to local adaptation and the development of unique material cultures and biological makeup, followed by genetic cultural mixing. Their conclusion was that the evolution of the human populations in Africa were multi-regional. Our ancestry was multi-ethnic, and the evolution of our material culture was multicultural. Science will need to look at regions of Africa to understand the human evolution. Let me drop for questions or comments. Okay. For some people, certain sounds like trumpet blowing a particular tone can make them dizzy. It's been estimated that 1 in 100 people around the world have a congenital inner ear condition known as semicircular canal dehiscence, a thinning of the bone enclosing the inner ear that can lead to vertigo in response to certain sounds, changes in atmospheric pressure, or coughing. It is a condition in which a person can feel the same imbalance effect as being drunk just by hearing certain tones, even from the sound of someone's voice or a musical instrument. Researchers from the University of Utah, Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, and the University of Mississippi have discovered how that happens and have published their findings in a recent issue of Scientific Reports. Let me drop. Normally, the inner ear balance and hearing organs are encased in solid bone, but in 1929, Italian biologist Pietro Culio discovered that a hole in that bony enclosure can cause the inner ear semicircular canals to become sensitive to acoustic sounds like a sustained tone from a musical instrument such as trumpet, violin, or a piano, even a higher-pitched conversation. This condition causes the eyes to rotate through an automatic reflex that normally would stabilize the image in the eye during head movement. But if the signal coming from the ear is wrong, the eye movements are also wrong, causing the patient to feel dizzy. Let me drop. The effect can occur in just seconds. If the right tone is played, and it can render the person dizzy for tens of seconds, even after the tone is stopped. By monitoring the neurons and inner ear fluid motion in toadfish, which have similar inner ear balance organs as humans, it was discovered that this dizzying effect occurs when the sound generates pathological fluid mechanical waves in the semicircular canal of the ears. Normally, inner ear fluid moves when you rotate your head, and your eyes automatically counter-rotate to stabilize the image on the retina. We've talked about that in the past. But then there is this pathological hole in the bone certain acoustic tones cause, and the inner ear fluid to pump. And as a result, the ear sends an incorrect signal to the brain, and you're rotating your head when you're not. In short, your eyes counter-rotate the wrong way, and it will look like the world is spinning. Fortunately, surgical repair of dehiscence can help patients, but researchers now understand the connection of how a small hole in a bone can create a lifetime of debilitating dizziness for many. And that's it for this week, gentlemen. I hope you've been entertained.
Roy, WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Are you saying the hollow bone is causing tinnitus, this high-pitched noise that people hear? Is that what you're saying?
No, tinnitus is a different entity entirely. It's the inability of the ear to do sound reduction, noise reduction of an overactive set of nerves. This gives imbalanced sensation as though their semicircular canals, which have fluid in them, are being tweaked and movement is being produced by the sound waves. And so it's giving a false sense of motion where nothing's really moving, but your brain kind of gets very upset with the conflicting evidence that it sees.
Okay, and the end story is what? That they figured out that by removing this bone or doing something with it or filling it up with some kind of material, the person, they're not going to experience this anymore? Is this something new that they've come up with in research?
Well, they discovered the abnormality back in 29, and it's between then and now, they tried just thickening up the bone where it was getting opened up, and it alleviates most of the symptoms. What this particular study was demonstrate exactly why the thinness in a certain portion of the semicircular canal can give apparent signals to your brain that motion is occurring when you're not moving anywhere. So this doesn't really help in the solution. They already kind of figured it out on an anatomical. This study was more to explain why it does that.
Okay, I got it. Very good. All right, initially I thought you were talking about tinnitus, and I went from one thing to the next there. Okay, well, tinnitus is that's another problem. I've never been diagnosed with that, but I once in a while you hear it ringing, and I thought maybe that would be it, that they were finding a cure for that, but I guess not. By the way, there's a terrible commercial on CBS, and the commercial is for tinnitus, and there's a tone that they put out. I'm driving along, and you hear this tone, and it's very low, but it's about that same pitch that I think somebody would normally hear with tinnitus. And then it goes away, and then later on the commercial comes back again. They got to stop this commercial because it's annoying when you're driving, and it goes off. You think you're hearing it, and I mean it's really a stupid commercial to put on. I'll have to listen for it again and find out who's advertising this thing. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, unfortunately, television is well known for all kinds of annoying little things. There was a time that one or two producers used to put in a lot of low-frequency sounds in their sound background to give people a kind of uncomfortable sensation. And I think it was a little bit too effective, so they've done away with that. And producers have to be very cautious if they have flickering images on their shows because you can induce seizure disorder in some people, and they'll sue your backside. There's a lot of unfortunate ways that television can not be a good thing for us. So, all things in moderation, as the saying goes.
Okay, understood. Yeah, but I was thinking about CBS radio, you know, 880 kilohertz on a dial. I'm talking about actual radio. Yeah, commercial. CBS, another world. I don't get it. You put the news on, I don't get what station is. In the first 3 minutes, they're blasting music as they're telling you all the, you know, the stories that they're going to cover. And, you know, half the time, I don't even know what they're talking about. They have music going as they're talking. Just shut the music off and talk about the news, but they don't do that. So, yeah, TV, that's another story. Okay, Roy, back to you. WS2.
Yes, television loves to compress audio and boost things, and I think they're aiming at people with no attention span. So you have to keep snapping your fingers in front of the audience in these guys' opinions in order for you to be interested in what's on the show. So it's a sad kind of commentary to what television producers think of their audience.
Okay, I concur. And if you weren't dopey before you started watching it, after years of watching this, you're going to become dopey. What are you going to do? Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, there's a reason why they call it the boob tube. But, you know, again, all things in moderation. Some shows on television, especially documentaries, but some well-done dramas can be entertaining and can elucidate the behavior of our fellow man. So I think that television is just a tool, like a hammer. You could either use a hammer to build a house or you could bash someone's head in. Sometimes I feel the television is trying to bash heads in.
Very good. And okay, on the documentaries, yeah, I tend to watch them. In fact, PBS just had a good one about the Rocky Mountains. So, you know, you think, what am I going to learn watching this? Turns out there's this little tiny bird that flies from all the way from northern Canada all the way down to Mexico. 3,000 miles it flies, you know. And they showed the whole process of what this bird goes through. Whoever heard of that, not me. Maybe you did. Back to you, Roy, and then we'll go on, I guess, if Dick's available.
And the beauty of it is that you don't learn something until you learn it. So you don't know it was there until you learn it, and it's nice to kind of learn something new every day if you can. So just as I wrap it all up, once again, if you are interested in any topic, any question, any answer, any statement, what have you, it's mailbag@ac2gs.com, mailbag@ac2gs.com, and I will give you a list of links to the appropriate articles of everything that I've mentioned tonight if you go to roy.ac2gs.com. So I hope you've enjoyed it. I hope you come back next week for another episode.
Thank you, Roy. And now I think it's time for the latest space report. WS2N, KQRIW, go ahead, Paul.
Thanks, Dick. Okay, very good. WS2N for the SpaceNet report, number 307 we're up to. Wanted to talk a little bit about these private companies that are launching spacecraft. And some of them are going to be for people, and some of them are going to be for orbital spacecraft. There's going to be thousands and thousands of spacecraft that are going to be launched in the future if all these different companies have their way, including for internet connections and more weather type of satellites, and it's just going to be overwhelming from what I see. There's there's like 10,000 satellites that they have on a manifest globally. So a lot of companies would like to join that group and launch satellites for them. So they're building these different spacecraft and launches. And one of them is actually building two different types, and that's Virgin Galactic. Virgin Galactic is the one that's building Spaceship Two, and that's the one that's going to carry people, carry up to 8 people, two pilots, and then 6 passengers. And it looks like they're getting further along, and maybe within 6 months. They say before that they'll be able to launch their first commercial flight to a suborbital flight, and that will be taking place in New Mexico, a place called Spaceport America. That was built by the state of New Mexico's, New Mexico taxes built this thing years ago, and they're many years behind when they thought they were going to have companies there on a regular basis, but they're getting to the point where Virgin Galactic might be able to do that within 6 months. They have an airport, or if you want to call it a spaceport, for all these suborbital types of flights that will be taking place. And Virgin Mobile has a contract with them to be there. I said Virgin Mobile, and yeah, they also own the telephones, Virgin Galactic. So they also are developing a launcher system. They have a 747 that they took, and they're attaching a rocket to the bottom of the 747. It's going to be fueled with RP-1, that's liquid kerosene and liquid oxygen, a two-stage rocket. And they're getting further and further along in their development of that, and they expect to launch that probably, they said, within a couple of months. So let's call it the end of the year, the latest. But once they have that up and running, they'll be able to launch 3,000-pound satellites into space up to that number. So they plan on, they need a spaceport for that process. And now Spaceport America, New Mexico, will be one of them. But now they're signing a deal with Italy. Country Italy has an airport in the southern part of Italy. I can't pronounce the name of it, but they've been approved to become a spaceport as well as an airport. And they plan on launching not only Launcher 1. Launcher 1 is the rocket that's going to be attached to the bottom of the 747. And we'll also be launching the Virgin Galactic space plane. So, now that's probably a couple of years away, but it gives you an idea that, what's going on. Europe will actually have a place to launch vehicles, not only into the suborbital flight with their space plane 2, spaceship, they call it Spaceship 2. But also using their 747, they actually have a name for it called Cosmic Girl. They have it on the side of the 747. They're going to be launching Launcher 1 also from that airport as time goes on. So they'll have two locations, one in New Mexico and one in Italy. Let me drop it. Now, last week, after the night, I believe it was Monday, they had a Progress cargo vehicle launch from Kazakhstan. Russia launches these things on a regular basis. They launch it on a Soyuz rocket. Progress goes up and docks with the International Space Station. This process usually takes 34 hours or so, sometimes 2.5 days, usually to launch, get themselves set up in orbit, and eventually dock with the International Space Station. takes a lot of fuel to do that, and they would like to cut that time down. They've been trying to do this now for the last couple of years. They're trying to do it on just two orbits, roughly 3.5, a little over 3.5 hours of time from launch to docking. Well, that first time was successful last week. I saw the launch, and then like 4 hours later or 3.5 hours later, I was watching it again on NASA TV. NASA TV puts it on because so it's a Russia launch. It brings stuff to the International Space Station. So NASA TV had it on. They had beautiful pictures looking down at Earth and of this Progress spacecraft coming up to the International Space Station to dock on the bottom side of the spacecraft. They call it the Nadir location. It appears docking module, which is part of the Russian segment. But not too long ago, about a year and a half ago or so, they had a Russian spacewalk, and they were out there. One of the jobs they were doing was installing these high-definition cameras looking down at the Earth, and we did the same thing not too long ago with one of our spacewalks. We have cameras that are now pointing in the right direction for approaching spacecraft that will be coming to the space station in not too distant future, with a crew on board, either from the Boeing Starliner or from Dragon, the Dragon crew vehicle by SpaceX. So I'll be anxious to see those pictures when that first starts to happen, because these pictures were phenomenal. Watching this in high definition of this spacecraft coming up very slowly to meet with the International Space Station, and they showed right up to docking, and it was quite incredible. So that was a success. By doing that, they're able to save time, and that helps them in two ways. One, if there's a crew, the crew doesn't have to spend 2.5 days floating around in this tiny Soyuz spacecraft waiting to dock with the space station. They can do it in less than 4 hours. So that's number one. And number two, it saves a lot of fuel. By saving fuel, the Progress ship now has extra fuel on board. One of the jobs of Progress is to reboost the International Space Station. Before Progress ever leaves the space station, that's what they do. They use up most of their fuel, whatever's left over. Now they'll have more fuel to boost the space station a little higher each time. Space station, if that doesn't happen, will degrade over time, roughly 2 kilometers, every month or so. So that's a big plus, that was successful. Progress will be docked there probably for 4 to 5, 6 months. They'll load it up with junk and eventually deorbit it from the space station, and it will burn up over the Pacific Ocean. So it's the first time now that they had, and since I think 2010, that they had 6 spacecraft attached to the International Space Station at one time. There's one other Progress cargo vehicle that was already attached to the space station before this one went up, so that made 2. Since you have a crew of 6 on board the space station, spacecraft that takes them up there, and it takes 3 people at a time, so you have 2 crew spacecraft, both Soyuz vehicles attached to the space station. So that makes 4. And then you also have 2 cargo, American cargo vehicles. One is the Dragon that is still docked to the Harmony node in the front of the space station. And then there's another one, the Cygnus, that went up a while back, that's also still attached to the space station. That's 6 vehicles attached all at one time to the International Space Station, which is pretty good. Now that 6 has just changed to 5 as of today, actually, of this morning. Cygnus, they call it Cygnus 9, separated from the space station today to, you know, go through its motions. It's got some science it's going to do. It's got some CubeSats it's going to deploy in the next few days away from the International Space Station. And then eventually it will take, it will deorbit using its 100-pound thruster to slow itself down to burn up over the Pacific Ocean. And it will take all the trash, thousands of pounds of stuff from the space station and burn it up over the Pacific. And the interesting thing about Cygnus, it's one of the goals of NASA was to eventually use Cygnus to help reboost the International Space Station. Now, where it was docked in the Unity module, Unity node, they call it, roughly the center of the space station as far as mass is concerned. So they wanted to conduct a test. They've never done this before with Cygnus. In fact, the last time any American spacecraft has helped boost the International Space Station was back in 2011. During STS-135 when Atlantis was docked to it. So it's been all these years. And they wanted to give it a shot with the Cygnus mission. So a few days ago what they did is before they decided to undock this thing and send it in to burn up, they wanted to use the same main thruster, this 100-pound thruster that is attached to the to the Cygnus to help boost the station. So you have to remember this thing is, if you were on the space station right now, the Cygnus was docked to the bottom port. So if you ignited that thruster, you wouldn't get the results that you need. You need to have the thrust going in the forward direction to actually boost it. The space station, you actually have to make it go faster. Instead of 17,500 miles an hour, you want to, add another 100 miles an hour to it in the forward direction, and that would get you to a higher altitude. So to do that, they had to prepare the space station before they ignited this 100-pound thruster. And what they needed to do is turn the whole space station, 1 million-pound space station, as big as a football field, if you're laying it down on a football field. They need to turn this whole thing 90 degrees and have the thruster actually pointing in the direction of travel. Now, to do that, they don't have all these little thrusters all over the space station. They have these momentum wheels, gyroscopic momentum wheels, and they're located in what's called the Z1 truss section. It happens to be above the American module of Destiny. That's its location. So they activated those things, and by making these momentum gyros turn, the whole space station eventually turns 90 degrees. So if you were in there and you were looking out the cupola is this seven-window module that you would normally sit in and look down at Earth or look at the approaching spacecraft that are coming up to meet you. If you were to look at that, you would all of a sudden not see the Earth anymore. You'd be looking in the direction where you came. So they rotated the whole spacecraft. They fired the Cygnus spacecraft. Actually a Japanese thruster, this 100-pound thruster. And they fired it for almost a minute, 50 seconds, just to see how this is going to work. And by doing it, they actually raised the space station. They said around 300 feet, 300 feet. So it's a test. Next time they're going to use, they'll use more fuel and they'll keep it going for a very long period of time to set up, 300 feet, maybe, a mile or two or higher than where it is. So after that, the momentum gyros come back on and eventually turn the space station back to where it was. The Cygnus then disconnects from the International Space Station, and then off it goes to its fiery death. Cygnus was built by a company called Orbital ATK. Now it's Orbital ATK, if you look that up anymore, that no longer exists because Northrop Grumman bought up Orbital ATK. So we have to give it a new name now, new designation. They keep changing things, but it's basically the same spacecraft, the Cygnus cargo spacecraft. And it's launched by an Antares rocket, again, built by now Northrop Grumman. Used to be Orbital ATK, and it was launched out of Virginia, Wallace Island, Virginia, a few months ago. So that's the story on Cygnus. And other spacecraft that are now under development, talking about the Crewed spacecraft by SpaceX, it has now been delivered to Florida for preparation. It went through a lot of testing in Ohio. They put it in this big contraption which duplicates space, vacuum temperature and all of that, and it passed all its tests. And now the crewed vehicle, along with the trunk, which is as big as the spacecraft, it's now down in Florida. Its first launch will be unmanned, and it will go to the space station. It will dock with the space station automatically without people, and then spend a couple of weeks, and then deorbit and then come back. It's the first test. And if that goes well, then they'll eventually have a crew on board. My guess, that probably won't happen until sometime next year. And then it will have a crew of two. WS2N for ID. And then what will happen will be it will be approved by NASA at that point, and then they'll say, okay, we're going to fly four at a time up to the space station. And instead of having six people as a permanent group on the space station, we're going to now have seven. And that day is not too far off in the future. And if that all doesn't work out, Boeing is building their Starliner, and eventually they will do the same thing. They will eventually launch a unmanned spacecraft to the space station, and then they will eventually follow it up with two astronauts as a test. So Starliner and the Dragon crew will be regular visitors to the space station, hopefully on a regular basis, a year or so from now. Let me drop it. A couple of CubeSats were launched from the Japanese portion of the space station. Japanese, everybody has a module up there. European Space Agency has the Columbus module. We have the Destiny module for the U.S. Russia has the Zvezda module for the Russia. Japan has a big module. Actually, Japan is the biggest module, and it's called the Kaibo module. And inside of Kaibo is this door that they can open up. It's a big airlock, and they can launch satellites from it. Well, they launched nine satellites a couple of days ago on the 13th. They opened up the airlock and pushed these things out the airlock, and off they went. And they're CubeSats. So there's nine of them that went out. But interesting enough, three of them were ham radio related. You have the Endosat, which is it's going to transmit on UHF 437.050 megahertz, and they're going to also have some kind of CW signal coming out of it. I believe they're, I'm not sure which group built this, different people build these different satellites. And then there's another one, Equus, that's going to transmit on 435.550 megahertz. Also has kind of a beacon. And then another one called MEMSAT. I'll have to look up who built all these three satellites. And that's going to transmit on 437.350. So you can see that. And then, of course, it's all 70 centimeters. So, new hamsats are up there. I see the transmit frequencies. I don't see the receive frequencies. I'll have to find out more information about these things. Let me drop it. You know, there's many ham radio satellites that are flying around up there. So I guess this is three more. I don't know how long they're scheduled to last. Sometimes they don't last all that long. But we'll have to find out. Another test that's going on is for another spacecraft that's being built by DARPA. DARPA is the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency. It spent a lot of money on space, the military budget. You know, everybody thinks of NASA as a big budget. Well, military space, the space portion of the military budget is actually twice that of NASA. So they're building a spacecraft called the Phantom Express, which they expect to launch next year. I don't even see a rocket yet for it for this thing, but it's a space plane, and it's under development. I know Boeing's involved and everything. The engine is now being tested. The engine is called the AR-22. AR-22 is a derivative of the RS-25. The RS-25 was the famous space shuttle engine that flew hundreds of times on the space shuttle. You know, you had three main engines, not the solid boosters, but the main engines, and they're called RS-25s. It delivered like, 500 pounds of thrust each, a little less than that, but these are going to be derivatives of that. They're basically the same engine, but they're changing it a little bit. The one that's doing this is Aerojet Rocketdyne, so it's called AR-22. And they just finished testing this 10 different days, 10 different tests. They set this up in Mississippi, down in Spanish, Mississippi. They put it in this big engine testing building, and they light it off. And they lit it off, and everything went fine for a couple of minutes, or like a two-minute duplication of what a launch would be. And then they shut it down, get it ready. The next day, they fire it off again. And the same thing the next day. Ten days in a row, 10 tests, identical tests. And the reason for all this is DARPA wants to have a space plane, unmanned, by the way, to put satellites into space. They need a space plane that's going to launch, that has the capability of launching 10 days in a row if they want. And it's got to be able to take off vertically off a launch pad. It's got to get up to Mach 10, 10 times the speed of sound. And on the back of this space plane is another rocket. And that's going to detach from the space plane with the satellite on board. And that's the piece that will bring the satellites to orbit. Space plane comes around, comes back, all the way back like the shuttle did, and lands on a runway. And then they want to be able to prepare it and launch it the next day. And the day after that, they need that capability. And from what I understand, they worry about somebody else shooting our satellites out of the sky with debris destroying them. And the government would like to have the capability of, in an emergency situation at least, to be able to put our satellites back up into space if somebody shoots them out of the sky. So they want that capability. But they're developing it. Boeing's developing the spacecraft. Nice pictures of it. And it's called the Phantom Express. So I want to see eventually how that works out. I have a couple of other topics, but I won't continue on right now. Dick, if you want to pick it up, or if anybody has any questions, this is WS2N for the SpaceNet report.
Cube
anything.
KT1SAN, I think it is. Yes, go ahead. This is Paul, WS1.
Yeah, Paul, what cube says oriented? Since they're so tiny, I sure can't have any thrusters in there. Or don't they have to be oriented? Back to you. I just see them as like tumbling up there.
Okay, yeah, I missed the first word or two. Something tumbling up there. Just run the question by me one more time, please. What's your first name?
Yeah, maybe my finger's quicker than my mouth here. Sorry about that. It's KC1 Sierra Alpha Mike, and the name is Sam Sierra Alpha Mike. The question is, what keeps the CubeSats oriented in a given position, you know, so that they work from up there down to Earth? I can't see any thrusters or anything in there. Maybe there are, but sure wouldn't last long. So what keeps them oriented, or are they designed so that they don't have to be? Back to you.
Yes, Sam. Okay, yeah, they have their antennas. The regular CubeSats are, 10 centimeters, like, four-inch cubes. And they have these antennas that come out. They're kind of like, a tape measure that you would have. You know, they extend like that. They roll out because of the same curvature like a tape measure has. They hold that shape. So the antennas come out like that. It's really essentially a dipole, and they're able to communicate with Earth that way, and they can rotate. And some of them, the newer ones, the bigger ones, they have, they call them CubeSats, so you'll have like 3U, 4U, 5U, each time that, you know, you go up in number, that's another cube. So a 6U CubeSat would have six cubes. If they're a big one like that, they can have like little thrusters on board. In fact, you have two of them right now on the way to Mars called Marco A, Marco B, and they have thrusters, and they also have little momentum wheels inside that help them orient themselves in space. But some of these smaller ones, I don't think they have anything, like you said. And it's just a dipole that's transmitting. I guess the signal, they don't worry about the signals, whether it's not circular polarized or anything. I guess whatever it is, it's good enough. It is in low Earth orbit. Most of them are only a couple hundred miles up.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I timed that out. Anybody else with an answer? I guess that's what we're going to do, Sam. Yeah, as far as I know, they just pushed them out. I mean, I seen them leaving the space station. You know, they've had video of that. And they looked pretty stable when they pushed them out. So I guess that's it, you know. And, they're not like spinning wildly, and I guess there's nothing to stop them spinning wildly. And that's about it, Sam. Back to you.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. Yeah, I'm envisioning, you said something like 10,000 of them. I guess if you got enough of them up there at any given minute, many of them are oriented right to transmit down to Earth. But whatever works, works. I appreciate it. KC1. Sierra Alpha Mike, I'll be standing by.
Yeah, let me clarify that. Yeah, I know in the beginning I said 10,000 satellites. Well, SpaceX wants to launch like 4,000. OneWeb, they call it. Another company wants to launch a couple of thousand of them. And their purpose is to have these things linking to one another, and so many of them going around the Earth, they'll have complete coverage of the Earth, and they'll be able to sell subscriptions, you know, for the internet. You know, instead of going through cable vision, now, you know, Verizon will be we'll be paying these companies and having antennas on a roof going up to the satellites in low Earth orbit. And it, when I say low Earth orbit, those things are scheduled to be around 350 miles up. So they're the ones that when I said thousands of satellites. Now, they're bigger. You know, they're not monstrous, but they are bigger. They will have thrusters on it, and, you know, all the capability of a bigger satellite, but each one would probably be, you know, maybe, you know, 300 pounds or 400 pounds or something, where the CubeSats are, you know, kilograms. I think they weigh like 4 pounds or something. Some very, very light. So, but yeah, the bigger ones will have that capability. In fact, they need to have the ability toward the end of their life. They need to be able to, you know, be able to turn around and fly their little thrusters to slow themselves down to deorbit. They don't need permanent space junk up at, you know, that altitude. So that's what I mean by that. You know, but the little CubeSats, I don't think they have anything there. Anything to keep them oriented, as far as I know. You know, I would think maybe some of the fancy ones might have magnet coil? What's the name of it? I forget the name. But, you know, little coils on the end would be good to interact with the magnetic field of the Earth. They actually have that on a lot of satellites. And then, you know, that would keep them oriented, picking up that magnetic field, and then using that to keep the satellite positioned one way or the other.
I didn't realize it was different sizes. I'm just envisioning these little
foreign. Okay, any other comments or questions?
In there, the way of, you know, guidance equipment. But, yeah, I guess if you have bigger ones, you can put anything in there. All right, I appreciate your you getting back to me, Paul.
Yeah, QSL, Sam. Yeah, that's the story. And let's see if those things get up, you know. I mean, a year or two ago, they were talking about 5 years. So we got 3 years now for space and internet. I'm not going to hold my breath, but now they're talking about, you know, the companies that are going to be supplying the antennas are running into cost problems. They're going to have all these satellites ready, and they're not going to have the antennas ready. I read that. I don't know. You know, the cost of not only the antennas for each customer, but the electronics that go behind it. It's not just, you know, an antenna. They have to supply the electronics. You know, transmitters, really transceivers to do this work. And, you know, who's going to pay for this? You know, I guess maybe through the subscription, you know, hopefully you get this antenna and transceiver free, and then through the monthly payments that you're going to have, you know, I guess that will eventually pay for it. I'm really going to be interested to see how this turns out. When's it going to happen, you know? I wouldn't be surprised if it's 10 years from now, but they say, you know, 5 years from now, or even less. I don't know about that. They're always very optimistic when it comes to talking about, you know, what they're going to have up. A lot of things come true, you know. I mean, SpaceX wanted to launch their Falcon 9 Heavy, which they just called the Falcon Heavy now. Three Falcon 9 boosters bolted together. This was supposed to happen originally, take off from Vandenberg Air Force Base in 2013. So many years ago, I read that. They finally did it. I mean, they launched at the beginning of 2018, which is 5 years later, and they launched from Florida, not California. But eventually, they get there. It's just that their predictions that they were going to have a crew go around the moon by the end of this year. I remember a couple of years ago. Would they eventually do that? Yeah, SpaceX might be able to do that. You know, send somebody up and two people in a Dragon around the moon. It could happen. but not this year. Their predictions are usually wildly way off, I think. Any other comments or questions for the net? This is WS2N.
Paul, I'd like to ask a couple of questions. I should know and I don't, about a space-borne internet system. The good news is that a constellation of satellites covers almost every single place on the planet, so nobody would be left out. People who live in a very rural area who don't have cable TV or fiber optics, in many cases, don't have internet. So a space-borne system at first sounds good, but now if the actual satellite doing the work was at a synchronous altitude, 22,000 miles, you would aim the antenna at it, bolt it down to the ground in your backyard, and you're in like Flynn. But now that's a long distance and a long time delay to overcome. I'm guessing that the space-borne internet system is supposed to be either low Earth or LEOs or MEOs, low Earth or medium Earth altitude satellites, which means that the satellite goes from horizon to horizon. So if the satellite doesn't have a scanning antenna, an antenna that follows the satellite on the ground in your backyard, it's going to have a very broad pattern. A very broad pattern is low in gain. So now you're between a rock and a hard place of having a system that's affordable, having enough power on the satellite to talk to the antennas on the ground, and the antennas on the ground have enough gain, even though they get this very broad pattern. So roughly, what is the scheme right now is being proposed? How high are the satellites? How many of them? And what do you think that ground-based antenna looks like? Don't have to worry about what frequency it's on. Over you, Paul, K2IW.
Yeah, I know they're all in there. I think 1.2 or giga. I think 1.2 gig or higher. I'm trying to remember. I think they were KU too. This is going to be a combination. I'm not sure of the frequencies. But you're going to have this antenna, and it's going to be able to copy the one antenna for, say, 6 minutes as it goes, one satellite, 6 minutes as it goes overhead. And then as that one leaves, another one's coming by, and that's also going to pick that one up for 6 minutes. And these things are all linked together. And then they're all, they have gateways on the Earth all over the place. Not satellites in the geosynchronous orbit, but the gateways are going to be on the Earth. And then they'll be, at one point or another, a satellite will always be over a gateway, transmitting directly down. So you only got to have this small latency period, going up to 400 miles up in the air, and then back down again, instead of 22,000 miles. So you're not going to have this big latency period. So it would be good for communications, talking. There might be a slight delay. But they say right now, when you communicate, using the today's technologies, there is a slight delay in talking. You see, when you talk to Europe or something, there is a noticeable period, some people, they pick it up. Sometimes you'll notice it on the news when you're watching the news and they're talking to somebody far away. It could be, even in our country, there's a delay. I see that all the time. And they predict it will be less of a delay than that. So it will be great for text. For internet connections, you look through websites, you won't notice any kind of a delay whatsoever. Communications, there might be something, but you're not going to have this, 23,000 mile up, 23,000 down problem. It'd be 400 up and 400 down. Back either.
If there's going to be another satellite passing overhead every 6 minutes, it sounds like you've got to install a huge number of satellites. many tens of satellites, is what it sounds like. And I get the impression